season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. To Autumn by John Keats, the opening verse. Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined today by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI, and we are here to talk about autumn. Now, one of the things that really fascinates me about autumn, and I think it's my favourite season, I don't think I'm alone in that, is that there's a rich ambiguity to it all. At first, there's this very purposeful aspect of it. It's the beginning of a new term. It's starting again after the summer holidays, the innovations of the summer holidays. In fact, I think it's F. Scott Fitzgerald who says, life starts all over again when it gets crisp in the falls. And yet there's also this melancholy aspect, this sadness. We see and feel the proximity of the year's end. Spring and summer are long gone. And there's a lot of literature in particular which is really, really infused with this melancholy. In fact, it's George Eliot, the great English novelist, who said, is not this a true autumn day? Just the still melancholy that I love, that makes life and nature harmonise. And it's as though these are two sides of the same coin. And this is what makes autumn such a rich and certainly artistically inspiring month.
Autumn is almost a uniquely creative season. I think if you were to ask me what my idea of any other season was, my idea of spring, idea of winter or summer, I would struggle to answer with the kind of range of associations that you get with autumn.
No, that's exactly right. If I think of a great work that I associate with spring, let's say, for instance, Schubert's great Lieder, Im Frühling, to spring, there's absolutely no ambiguity about it at all. It's, look, here's spring, you know, the sun's going to shine and it's all going to be nice and happy, but it's relatively simple. And what I think makes autumn so fascinating from an artistic sense, and also one as an experience of autumn, is the ambiguity we talk about. And yet I'm slightly surprised by one of Keats's lines into autumn. And let's face it, that's the kind of, you know, lodestone of autumnal art, is, and I believe, the most anthologized poem in the English language. Certainly one of them. But in one of the lines he says, of autumn, thou hast thy music too, as though it's a kind of apology, as though, you know, everywhere else has got all the music, but, oh, you know, you'd be surprised that autumn has this. And I think this is bizarre, because when I think of autumn, I think of lots and lots of songs. Verlaine's great poem, Chanson d'Automne, which actually I think is even better in the Charles Trenet song, you know, that great opening verse, Les Anglais longs de violon de l'automne, blessez mon coeur d'une longueur monotone. And that is such a fantastic song, but there are others, you know, you think of Autumn Leaves. And above all, I think, the great song by Maxwell Anderson and Kurt Weill, September Song, which has been recorded by so many great artists, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, Bing Crosby, and I think possibly, above all, Frank Sinatra and Lottie Lenier, of course, was Kurt Weill's wife.
Well, and Frank Sinatra's September of My Years actually came out when he was 50, which I think, I don't know, but many 50-year-olds listening would say that they're in the September of My Years.
Not sure about that.
Yeah, exactly. That Verlaine poem, Chanson d'automne, was used by the Special Operations Executive in the Second World War as a code to broadcast to D-Day. So they used one stanza to signal that it was like 2 weeks to go.
Yep.
And then they used another to say, you know, it's happening. It's quite difficult to think of a cultural reference point which would be just so recognisable to people at large. I don't know.
Although, of course, it's made great by the event. But I think there is this propulsion about autumn. And I think this is demonstrated so brilliantly in Kurt Weill's September Song, that great verse that goes, "And the days turn to gold as they grow few. September, November." And there is this idea of time getting tight, and these few golden days I'd spend with you, these golden days I'd spend with you. And of course, gold being very much a colour we associate with autumn. And we think of the lovely American word, I think, for the season, the fall.
That stanza puts a vision of autumn that is more interesting, perhaps, than some of the more gothic sort of extreme depictions of autumn as this sort of overblown time of melancholy and, you know, passing into a kind of eternal winter. I'm really thinking about Charles Baudelaire's Chant d'automne, which was written in 1859, before Verlaine's Chanson d'automne in 1866, which was addressed to his lover, who had apparently just decided to live with another poet. In the contrast between the Verlaine and the Baudelaire, you can see one poem, the Verlaine, which is almost a perfect poem. The verse structure, the rhyme, the sort of liquidity of the images, how can violins be sobbing, songbird means sobs, you know, it kind of, the shape of it sort of merges off the page, and it's also so pithy. Whereas Baudelaire, it's a lot more sort of mad. He talks about how the tomb is waiting for him, it's empty. He's pleading for it to his lover to just be anything to him, to be a mother, to be a sister, just to keep him away from this abyss. And then he talks about the white and torrid summer giving way to the last yellow ray of autumn, and then entering into a kind of polar hell of winter. And there are beautiful moments in it, but it lacks the economy of that Verlaine poem. So I think we do owe this idea of autumn, this kind of melancholy idea, to the 19th century. And I think it's quite nice to reflect on how varied autumn has been over time. It's not always been thus. Think of in the medieval period, there's so many beautiful manuscripts in which people are depicted. Autumn is the time of grape harvest. It's a kind of pastoral background, a pivotal moment in the calendar. Autumn's often been depicted as like the Roman god Bacchus, who's of course the
yep.
god of feasting and wine. And I think that also reflects on people's drinking habits often change in the autumn season. You move away from summer into a kind of maybe richer, maybe more red wine or whatever.
There's a contemplative nature to it. I always associated with the season of reading as well, I think.
I think even if you look at the etymology of autumn, I mean, autumn's actually, so Herbst in German, Herfst in Dutch. The old English was Herfest, whereas we've got autumn, which actually comes through French. But in medieval times, people used autumn, harvest, and sort of stock phrases like the time of falling leaves pretty interchangeably.
And you always think, or at least I always summon up a Bruegel landscape for this. There's a kind of ribaldry about it all as well that I always associate with autumn. But I'm convinced by your idea that the autumn that we think of as we conceive it is a largely 19th century idea. There's a romantic aspect of that. But I think even if you look at Keats, not just to autumn, but of course, Ode to a Grecian Urn, much of that inspiration there is inspired by the rediscovery of the classical world. You know, Keats was an aficionado of the Elgin marbles, And so it's a kind of 19th century reimagining of the classical world, or the classical approach to autumn as well. Because, so far as I understand, and you're the classicist, Alistair, there is no kind of sense of winter in Greek. The obsession with the triple form, with trios in Greek, means that there was a spring, there was a summer, there was an autumn, but no real winter.
Yeah, they sort of don't really have an idea of it, but they do have a sort of time off, what was called the Saturnalia. So they have sort of 3 weeks where they just go off various partying. I think it happened in around December. And I think that does illustrate how culturally constituted our idea of the seasons are, especially in a context, especially in the 19th century, where you see massive population transfers from the land to cities. One of the great texts of modern Scottishness, the novel The Sunset Song by Lewis Gresset Gibbon, which is set in kind of fin de siècle Scotland, in northeast Scotland, just before the First World War. It's structured around the seasons, so the chapter titles, you know, ploughing, for example, and this idea of spring, summer and harvest giving way, the sun setting over the kind of old Scots folk, the last of the peasants, I think is a quote from the novel. And that is probably one of the most popular novels in Scotland, I think, because it addresses full square this idea of the land, and this land with a capital L, the land that we have left behind, the land that has been, for some Scots, stolen from us by vicious, exploitative people who run the estates, landowners. This is an idea of an eternal Scotland that lies behind modern society, an idea that there is something that endures of an older Scotland, even a country which was exposed pretty brutally to industrial revolution, and to vast scale of emigration. And I think what explains some of the popularity of that novel, which is really about farming life, and about a farming life that came to an end with the First World War. So many people in rural communities died. A lot of the farmers were consolidated into much bigger estates centered around a farmhouse rather than the kind of small tenant farmer. It's there in English culture as well, this melancholy of what the First World War did to society.
And it's heightened with autumn, because we're going back to this theme of ambiguity again. It's heightened by the fact that it is touched by both summer and winter. It is this transitional phase that it offers all the fruit that it delivers all the fruit that summer offers, while warning us of the winter ahead. I wonder how much this will change, at least in temperate climes where there are seasons, how much this will change through the phenomenon of climate change, that we won't have those sort of lengthened elisions between summer, autumn and winter that we have grown used to.
It's not just that, it's the kind of technological situation we're in. Our sense of time and of ourselves as temporal beings is constantly being interfered with. The way in which so much of our lives are mediated through screens, which have their own, as we all know, technology affects us just as we use it. They have their own rhythms, they have their own kind of anxious commentary, they have their own ways of relating to us. And I think many people are finding that quite unsatisfactory, and find that it makes them unhappy, but they find that it's so necessary to being a modern human being. You have to relate to other human beings through a kind of technologically mediated reality. It feels like that world, that older world, the old folk who depended on the seasons in a very fundamental way, whose livelihoods depended on it, those people are fewer and fewer, and it feels harder and harder for us to feel intuitively close to the seasons as we might have experienced them. And I think that's where modern culture offers compensatory devices like reading the seasons through poetry or literature. It can open up a way for us to make us feel better about being effectively human animals who depend on the seasons, but we don't really like to admit it, and modern life is constructed in such a way that it hides that reality. In terms of inspiration for thinking about the seasons in a way that lifts us out of ourselves, that gives us a sense of being beings, as I say, in time, dependent on the natural world, all the things I think that we sort of crave. The reaction, for example, to Rainer Maria Rilke's poem Herbsttag, Autumn Day, which in October, November 2020 was, I saw constantly retweeted and screenshotted on Twitter and other social media to talk about the experience of lockdown. Mm. It was a period, I think, we will all remember, particularly in the UK, when there was a kind of anxious argument in the UK about whether we'd go into lockdown or not through October and November. And then finally in December and January, we did go into a lengthy lockdown. In other European countries, they were already in lockdowns. In France, it began early and it went right the way through. But this poem, I think you'll see quite clearly why people were tweeting it, ends with a stanza which begins, "He who has no home now will build no more. He who is alone now will remain alone. Will watch, read, write lengthy letters, and in the avenues will wander here and there restlessly as the leaves are blowing." Yeah. Which I think for many of us was an experience of those lockdowns. You know, if you were on your own, you were going to remain on your own. You would, as you say, Paul, you'd go back to reading literature to try and find some solace. And we wandered down many, many avenues kind of restlessly. And I think that illustrates almost calling out to the seasons, building up a fuller appreciation through art and literature of our relationship to the elements, particularly for modern people, is probably the most profound way in which we can do that. We aren't farmers dependent on the land. Ultimately, the avenue that is really available to us is potentially through the constellations of art.
And this kind of fecundity of imagination, this inspiration, is born of loss, because that really reminds me of what I think is one of the most moving poems about autumn, I presume, by no less than William Shakespeare, his 73rd sonnet, in which he writes this rather remarkable passage, I think. "That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest." And there is an association there of the autumn season, this idea of the trees being without leaves, being bare, which reminds Shakespeare, obviously, I think, of the church choirs, the choirs of the monastery, as he writes in the wake of the iconoclasm of the dissolution of the monasteries, one of the most profound revolutionary events in English history. But also here we have this genius who has seen this visual world stripped away, taken away, and there's all kinds of theories about what Shakespeare's particular religious proclivities were. Was he an Anglican? Was he a Catholic? There's been much supposition on that. I'm convinced neither way, I have to say, but it is that idea that a turning away from a visual world to a literary one that became a key staple of English culture. I think so. After Shakespeare, you have Milton and beyond, and then you have this powerhouse of literary form that is also born of this absence, which is the monasteries, the Catholic Church, the high ritual of that.
What do you think we might mourn now?
I think we do mourn that more literate culture, that complexity, the concentrations that's needed even to read a relatively short sonnet of Shakespeare's, just like the one I've just mentioned, the 73rd. There are the allusions too that really worry me in terms of the lack of a vocabulary about the natural world, about the religious world. And that, of course, is mirrored in the 73rd sonnet, where Shakespeare is mourning the loss of a certain worldview, perhaps a Catholic worldview, one that's based upon the visual, and a retreat into the literary that then becomes highly developed over centuries and then itself falls into retreat. I mean, there is a kind of pitilessness about this endless cycle that's mirrored there. And I think of Houseman's poem. It's not part of the famous Shropshire Ladder or anything. It's called "Be Tell Me Not Here, It Needs Not Saying." And there's a wonderful ending towards this when Houseman talks about nature. Heartless, witless nature will neither care nor know what stranger's feet may find the meadow and trespass there and go, nor ask amid the dews of morning if they are mine or no. And I think that talks to this idea of autumn as a place where we contemplate mortality. It's C.S. Lewis who captures this, I think, when he says in one of his letters, he talks about autumn is really the best of seasons, something I tend to agree with him. He also goes on to say, and I'm not sure that old age isn't the best part of life. I suppose we'll find out about that and make our own judgments. But he finishes, but of course, like autumn, it doesn't last.
I think, just to bring up Houseman again, it's also true in the rest of his poetry. Figures seem to be sort of disappearing almost mysteriously. Yeah, I think, again, thinking about the kind of this richer idea of autumn, it's actually a way of reading lots of other bits of life. But you can only really do that if you've got access, as we talked about, to a vocabulary.
Yeah, of course. There's a danger there of thinking that artistic genres are exclusive of one another. Mm. So we've talked about the way in which some of Shakespeare's work is influenced by the visual world, whether he sees it being created or he sees it being destroyed. I also think of Shakespeare's great successor and his only real rival as English national poet, John Milton. And if you read something like Paradise Lost, or indeed all of Milton's literature, you see a very, very strong musical influence. He uses words such as symphony, diapason, all the time, obviously influenced by his father, who was a gifted amateur musician, and the milieu in which he inhabited. But I think that sometimes we try to think that one genre replaces another, or one genre is exclusive from another, but of course that's not true at all. They all inform one another.
It's also worth noting that there is such a thing as autumn tourism. You know, people go to parts of America which have particularly vivid falls, like New England, and it brings in, I think, some millions of dollars of tourist money into those states.
That's only going to increase in Europe too, with the increase in temperatures. Who wants to sit through a Ferro Agosto now in Italy or anything when you can go to Greece in October or November? Those will become high seasons. We now have essentially a year-round season in Europe, and I'm sure that that will be increasingly true of other places as well.
So what does autumn mean to you personally, Paul? Do you have a favourite autumn in your life history that you can recall?
Not in particular. No, I don't think. As I say, I think it's always been my favourite season. I like that sudden onrush of slightly cold bit. I love the crunch of the leaves under the feet. I like the smoke and beer, as it used to be, of a football stadium as the breath of the crowd is exhaled. There's just something wonderful about that. I think of it as the beginning of the concert season in music. There's so much going on but it seems to inhabit an almost subterranean aspect to it. It tends to happen indoors, but there is something that's just very convivial about it. It's the way that people come together, I think, in autumn again. There's this idea again of starting anew, of picking up one's step, of being brisk into things. I mean, of course, it may well all collapse as winter comes along, but there is this frisson of renewed energy in public life, in social life, that propels itself through autumn. And it's a wonderful experience again and again, but again, there is this melancholy. Mm. One realizes one's mortality is mirrored in nature. You're getting closer to winter, you're getting closer to the end of the year. Every autumn is a reminder that you're getting closer to the end of life, however distant that may be, however close or how distant that may be. It is a reminder of our mortality. And so I think there's also this other impulse about autumn that makes one embrace life even more because of the fragile nature of existence.
Exactly. I think I can think of one autumn among other autumns, which I remember with particular clarity, which is of the 2008 financial crash. I just remember this, it sort of felt like I'd been thrown into consciousness of a world outside where I lived in Edinburgh of graphs plummeting downwards, of panic, of and particularly it gets dark really fast in autumn. Yeah. So it has a different quality to me, actually, autumn. And actually, when I moved to England, I began to experience autumn in a much richer and probably
a gentler way.
Gentler way, because in Scotland, it just gets really dark quite quickly. And you don't have, like here, this feeling of sort of 4 and 5 in the evening of wandering down avenues, of seeing the leaves illuminated by the, you know, the last rays of the sun, all that. The sun's gone. The sun has left the building. It's just dark. So I think that even within the UK, even within Europe, I imagine, and particularly in Scandinavia, autumn will feel very different. Yeah. Yeah. And there is no one sort of common experience of the kind of nature autumn.
Well, perhaps that's one of the reasons why it seems to be a particular inspiration to the arts of France and England, who seem to have this relationship. They're roughly, roughly on the same climate, particularly the southeast of England and the north of France. You know, it's basically one continuous landmass and culture that experiences very similar autumns.
And it's the same word for both.
And it is the same word, which of course makes it different from European neighbours as well as our transatlantic cousins.
At last, something in common with the French.
Yet another.
yet another
thing we have in common with our French cousins. So, so Alistair, we talk about this elision between summer, autumn and winter. When do you think autumn ends?
Well, I think autumn starts to begin to end after, for me at any rate, after Remembrance Sunday. It feels like that is a key sort of waymark on the way to winter, and certainly signifies the end of something in general. But
that's interesting, because I think there's a great deal in which the Great War, and obviously that is the fundamental reason why we have a Remembrance Sunday, Armistice Day as it was called, after the armistice that ended the First World War, that is in many minds the break between the old civilization and the new, that it was never the same again, to paraphrase Larkin.
We're in the autumn of we're in the autumn of European. If you think of the kind of incomparable strength and power of European culture before the First World War, I mean, it's very hard to recollect the sort of extreme qualities of that culture. And, you know, certainly the First World War It's where H.A.P. Taylor, the great historian, ends his account of the years following 1848. He ends it at 1918, a book called The Struggle for Mastery. And his reason is that with it, 1918, with the American interventions, the First World War, Europe was no longer sovereign, as it were. It was America was going to always, from then on, take a leading role in determining European security and the destinies of European nations. So it's not, I mean, that takes us back to Sunset Song by Lewis Gresset Gibbon, which is exactly about this moment. It probably is such an enduringly popular novel because it gets to something which I think we all know, that the First World War did signify the end of something so fundamental in our culture, kind of essential vitality that has been leaking out ever since.
And yet, the experience of autumn also tells us there is something to relish about that slow decline that's now been going on for more than a century, that European decline, as the rest of the world turns up. There may still be things to relish for a long time to come. We've spoken a lot about England, about Scotland, about France, about the United States. We never, it seems, mention Wales, but the greatest poet of recent years in Wales, R.S. Thomas, had a particularly good eye for the seasons and nature. So let us finish with his great poem, A Day in Autumn. It will not always be like this, the air windless, a few last leaves adding their decoration to the tree's shoulders, braiding the cuffs of the boughs with gold, a bird preening in the lawn's mirror, having lucked up from the day's chores. Pause a minute, let the mind take its photograph of the bright scene, something to wear against the heart in the long cold. So, Alistair and I will wrap up now and walk out into the foggy London streets. You've been listening to EI Talks. Goodbye. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.